Imagine for a second that you are incredibly thirsty. Like your throat is completely parched.
Oh, yeah, the absolute worst feeling.
Right. You're just desperate for a drink. But the crazy thing is, you were floating right in the middle of the
You're
ocean.
completely surrounded by water.
Exactly. Millions of gallons of it just stretching out to the horizon in every direction. But you can't drink a single drop.
Because none of it is actually drinkable.
Right. And if you did drink it, it would just, dehydrate you faster.
It's the human brain has a really hard time processing that kind of paradox. I mean, being surrounded by the exact thing you need, but being completely unable to metabolize it.
And we are plunging straight into that exact paradox today on the Deep Dive. Because look, we are living in the most digitally connected era in all of human history.
Without a doubt.
I mean, if you look at your phone right now, you have followers, you have infinite feeds. You can ping someone across the globe in 50 milliseconds.
We are absolutely drowning in connection.
We are. Yet, at the exact same time, we are right in the middle of a massive global loneliness crisis. We are thirsty in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah, and our instinct, and I think this is heavily reinforced by our culture, is to just treat that loneliness as a personal failing.
Like it's your own fault.
Right. If you feel isolated, the assumption is, well, you must not have enough friends. Or maybe your social skills are just rusty.
You just need to, put yourself out there more.
Exactly. But the data we are looking at today tells a completely different story.
Yeah, it really does. And today we're going to explore how this loneliness epidemic is actually not a lack of social skills on your part. It's a massive systemic design failure.
A failure of the very tools we use to communicate.
Right. The digital platforms we use every single day, they were intentionally optimized for engagement, keeping your eyes glued to the screen, not for genuine human connection.
And to figure out how we got here and, how we might actually escape it, we're pulling from a really fascinating stack of sources.
Yeah, we've got research, manifestos, and some really cool product insights from an organization called 3.2.1 Emotion.
Right, they're an emotional technology company based out of New York.
And they are actively trying to rebuild the internet's emotional infrastructure from the ground up, which is just a wild concept.
It is. But to understand why a tech company is treating this as an infrastructure problem, we first have to look at the physical reality of loneliness.
Because it's not just a feeling, right?
Exactly. Society tends to just brush it off as a fleeting mood, a bad afternoon or a temporary funk. But the medical field recognizes it as a measurable physiological state.
And one that does, catastrophic damage to the human body over time.
Yeah. The numbers in these sources are, frankly, they're hard to stomach.
Oh, they're terrifying. Look at the World Health Organization's 2025 Commission on Social Connection data. They found that 1 in 6 people globally experience persistent loneliness.
1 in 6.
Yeah. And they linked that to roughly 871,000 deaths a year.
Which, if you break that down, it's one death every 36 seconds.
Just pause and think about that for a second. Every 36 seconds.
It's staggering. And the U.S. Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, put out findings back in 2023 showing that chronic loneliness carries a mortality risk equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
15 cigarettes a day. That's a massive physical toll.
It increases your risk of heart disease by 29% and your risk of dementia by 50%.
Wow, 50%.
Yeah, the biology behind it is actually fascinating. If you think about it from an evolutionary standpoint, being separated from your tribe meant you were vulnerable to predators.
Right, it basically meant imminent death.
Exactly. So the body treats prolonged disconnection the exact same way it treats prolonged starvation. It triggers this massive survival emergency.
But your body just goes into overdrive.
Yeah, your nervous system floods with cortisol, your immune system degrades, and your body essentially lives in a constant state of physiological inflammation, just bracing for an attack that never comes.
Okay, let me push back on this a little bit, though. Because when I first read these stats, my immediate thought was, wait, are we conflating introversion with a public health crisis?
Oh, that's a really common question.
Because aren't some people just naturally inclined to prefer being alone? I mean, some of it has to just be people experiencing solitude, and we're slapping a medical label on it.
It's a fair point, but the research makes a very sharp distinction between those two states. Solitude is restorative, it's chosen.
Okay. Like taking time for yourself to
Right.
recharge.
Right. But loneliness is defined entirely differently. It is the painful, subjective distress you feel when there's a gap between the connection you have and the connection you actually need.
Okay, so the distress is the defining factor there.
Exactly.
So you could live completely off the grid in a cabin in the woods, not see another soul for months, and feel perfectly at peace. No cortisol spike at all.
Right, because you chose it and it meets your needs.
But conversely, you could be standing in the middle of a crowded room or, you know, have thousands of people liking a photo you just posted and be profoundly, painfully lonely.
Yes. And if we look at who is feeling that distress most acutely right now, the demographics completely flip our usual assumptions upside down.
Because we tend to picture loneliness as an affliction of the elderly, right?
Yeah.
Like someone older living alone after their family has moved away.
But the loneliest cohorts right now are teenagers, ages 13 to 17, and young adults, 18 to 29.
Basically, the generation that grew up with smartphones glued to their hand.
Exactly. The data shows that by 2024, the amount of in-person time that 15 to 25-year-olds spent with friends had collapsed to just 39 minutes a day.
Wow. Only 39 minutes.
Yeah. And that's down from 61 minutes a day in 2003. We are watching a total collapse of physical presence in a very short window of time.
So if loneliness is this painful gap between the connection we have and the connection we need, we really have to ask, why are digital tools widen that gap instead of closing it?
Right, because these platforms were supposedly built to connect us.
They promised this whole global village.
But they widened the gap because they systematically stripped away the very signals that human nervous systems actually rely on to feel safe and understood.
And the sources trace this all the way back to the foundational flaw of text messaging, right?
They do. There's this famous 2005 study by Kruger and colleagues. They found that plain text strips away roughly 37% of intended emotional meaning.
That is huge. Over a third of your intent just gone the second you hit send.
Exactly. And the problem is when you write an email or a text, you hear your own voice in your head. You hear your own sarcasm or your own warmth.
Right.
Because of that, senders confidently believe their tone is being understood about 88% of the time. But the receiver decodes it correctly only about 63% of the time.
Oh, man. We've all lived that overconfidence gap. I mean, think about the last time you sent a joke via text and then watched those three little gray typing dots bubble up on the screen.
Oh, the anxiety.
Yeah, feeling your heart rate spike while you wait to see if they realized you were actually kidding.
Bruh.
The text bubble completely erases all the physical context.
Because human tone is carried by prosody. That's the natural musical rhythm, the pacing, and the pitch of your voice.
And facial expressions, too, right?
Right. Micro expressions, posture, even the tiny pauses we take when we're just searching for a word. All of that incredibly rich biological data is flattened into a glowing gray rectangle.
I mean, emojis were introduced to fix this, obviously. But a static yellow cartoon face is a really low-resolution crayon drawing of a vastly complex emotional reality.
That's a great way to put it, and that texting flaw was just the foundation. The 3.2.1 emotion sources argue that the real crisis accelerated when platforms took that flattened communication and built business models entirely around it.
Right. To maximize engagement, the architecture of the web adopted a few core philosophies, these dogmas, that actively destroy intimacy.
The first dogma was measuring connection by follower count. Social platforms built their empires on visibility.
Visibility and volume. And when a system optimizes for performance, like broadcasting a curated version of your life to hundreds or thousands of people, it structurally suppresses vulnerability.
Absolutely. Because vulnerability requires safety and a manageable audience. Performance is the exact opposite.
It creates this whole society of people constantly performing for each other, which just leaves everyone feeling completely unseen.
And once the platforms gamified our friendships, they inevitably came for our romantic lives.
Oh, the dating apps.
Right. The second dogma. They decided that human compatibility could be sorted in a half-second swipe.
We took the complex, beautiful, terrifying reality of human fit and just reduced it to a visual judgment.
And the psychological toll of that specific design choice is immense. A 2024 Forbes health survey found that 78% of dating app users report feeling emotionally exhausted.
78%. I mean, that makes sense. You cannot see a person's emotional regulation or their sense of humor or their capacity to repair a disagreement in a heavily filtered selfie.
No, you can't. You're just pulling a slot machine lever over and over again, hoping for a dopamine hit.
And because people get so exhausted by the performance of social media and the slot machine mechanics of swiping, they retreat. And that leads to the third dogma. They drift into parasocial relationships.
Right. We start replacing reciprocal close ties with one-sided bonds.
Exactly. You watch a creator's daily vlog, you listen to a podcast, you feel like you know them intimately. You feel a very real sense of comfort.
But the creator cannot feel what the viewer feels. It's a counterfeit connection.
Yeah.
True human connection requires four very specific non-negotiable ingredients, according to the research. You need vulnerability, which is the willingness to share something with actual emotional risk.
Okay, vulnerability is one.
Then you need reciprocity, being felt and understood by the other person and doing the exact same for them.
Right.
Third is presence, that focused, sustained attention. And finally, safety. An environment where your vulnerability won't be exploited.
And modern platforms suppress every single one of those ingredients just to maximize your time on app.
They really do.
Because if you are truly vulnerable online, you might get attacked by strangers.
Yeah.
So safety is gone.
Yep.
If you're looking for deep reciprocity, you just get a generic like button instead. It's like replacing sleep with caffeine.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
Substituting deep, close ties with hundreds of weak ties or parasocial relationships keeps you moving for a little while. You feel the artificial buzz. But eventually, your nervous system simply crashes because it's completely devoid of actual nourishment.
And the tech industry is well aware of this exhaustion. They see the user fatigue. But their newest solution introduces perhaps the most dangerous shift in the digital landscape to date.
The AI companions.
Exactly. Chatbots specifically designed to talk to you, validate you, and keep you company when you feel too tired to deal with humans.
Okay, I want to pause here because this is where the debate gets really messy. I've read research that seems to enthusiastically support AI companions.
There is research out there, yes.
Like, there was a 2024 Harvard Business School study that essentially concluded that AI actually reduces loneliness. It gives people an immediate, judgment-free outlet to vent their feelings.
That's true. They did find that.
Right. So if someone is isolated, isn't an AI that will listen to them at 3 a.m. better than nothing? I mean, isn't that a net positive?
So the Harvard study is accurate regarding short-term relief. An AI companion does provide an immediate drop in distress. It acts basically as a conversational painkiller.
A painkiller, okay.
But we have to look at the architectural mechanism over time. There was a major longitudinal study published in May 2026 by Folk and Dunn in the journal Psychological Science.
Okay, so a very recent study.
Yes, and they tracked 2,149 adults across four countries over an entire 12-month period. They didn't just ask how people felt in the moment, they tracked the trajectory of their isolation.
Wow. Okay, so they're looking at the actual compound interest of talking to a machine for a year. What did the participants do, and what did the researchers actually find?
Well, participants were turning to these chatbots for social interaction. You know, venting about a bad day at work, discussing relationship anxieties.
Stuff you'd normally call a friend for.
Exactly. And the study revealed two distinct arrows of causality. The first arrow confirmed your point. People who felt emotionally isolated actively sought out chatbots for relief. They were in pain and they wanted a frictionless listener.
Right. They're thirsty in the ocean, grabbing whatever looks like water.
Beautifully put. But the second arrow is where the system completely collapses. 4 months later, those exact individuals who had increased their chatbot use reported significantly greater emotional isolation than when they started.
Wait, really? The hole they were trying to fill actually got deeper.
It got worse. Yes.
But wait, the tool they used to cure their loneliness made the biological reality of their loneliness worse? What is the mechanism behind that? How does talking to something make you more isolated?
Researchers call it the crowding out effect. The AI offers an interaction that is sufficient but not nutritious.
Sufficient but not nutritious.
Right. It's incredibly easy. The chatbot never gets mad at you. It never misunderstands you. It never has a competing need.
So it's zero friction.
Zero. But because it's a machine with no inner life, it has nothing at stake. It cannot be vulnerable, and it cannot offer true reciprocity.
It just perfectly mirrors whatever you want to hear. I mean, it absorbs your venting without challenging you or relating it to a shared human struggle, which is how actual bonds are formed.
And because it offers that incredibly easy, frictionless simulation of being heard, it occupies the relational bandwidth you would have otherwise used to reach out to a human.
Oh, I see.
It relieves just enough of your discomfort that you lose the motivation to text a real friend, navigate their schedule, and do the messy, sometimes frustrating work of maintaining a real relationship.
It takes away the necessary friction that drives us toward each other.
Mm.
That is chilling. I mean, if you numb the hunger pangs with an AI, you never go look for real food, and you quietly starve to death.
Precisely. And the 3.2.1 emotion sources identify this as an architectural failure. AI companions are currently optimized for substitution.
Right.
Their core metric for success is keeping you engaged with the chatbot itself, treating the software as the final destination.
When it should be an on-ramp.
Yes. The researchers argue we desperately need an architecture of preparation. Tools that act as an on-ramp, helping you process your feelings solely so you can go have a meaningful interaction with a real person.
Okay, so if current text messaging strips away our emotion and social media forces us to perform, swiping exhausts us, and AI companions slowly crowd out our human ties,
yeah.
We need a completely new infrastructure.
A total teardown.
And this brings us to the core thesis of 3.2.1 emotion. They argue we must radically shift how we view emotional intelligence, or EQ.
Because for decades, we've treated EQ as a personal score, a skill gap that you individually have to fix by going to therapy or reading self-help books.
But they propose treating emotional intelligence, what they term EI, as a shared infrastructure. Think about the highway system or the power grid.
Right. We don't ask people to individually build their own roads to connect with someone.
Exactly. We build shared infrastructure that makes travel safe and efficient. And they are attempting to build that for human emotion, starting with the design principle of augmentation rather than substitution.
So instead of a chatbot that talks to you like a fake friend, they built a conversational mirror. It's simply called IMO.
And it doesn't pretend to have feelings.
Not at all. It acts as an interactive journal to help you raise your emotional granularity.
Okay, emotional granularity.
Yeah, it helps you figure out the difference between saying, I feel bad versus I feel dismissed or I feel exposed. It just helps you find the precise words so you can turn around and hand those words to a real human being.
Which is awesome. But finding the words is only the first half of the equation. Because once you have them, how do you transmit them across a network without losing that 37% of meaning we talked about earlier?
Right. How do you prevent the glowing rectangle from flattening your vulnerability?
This is where the technology gets really wild. They developed a brand new file format. Like,
yeah.
We use MP3s for sound, JPEGs for images. They created the .emo file format.
Treating a message not as a string of text, but as an entire emotional scene.
Yes. In an emotional scene, layers multiple sensory inputs to basically bypass the cognitive brain and speak directly to the nervous system.
So a .emo file combines the text with voice, subtle lighting changes on the screen, and haptic rhythms.
The haptics are brilliant. I mean, imagine holding your phone, and instead of just reading a text that says, I'm so sorry, you feel a slow, steady pulse vibrating in the palm of your hand, mimicking a calming heartbeat.
Wow.
Or, if someone is excited, the rhythm is faster and lighter.
That's incredible, because feeling a physical pulse while reading a message directly signals the biological markers for presence and safety that plain text usually destroys.
Exactly. And they also replace static emojis with feelmoji, which are adaptable visual signals that shift based on the intensity of the emotion being conveyed. It's like moving from a black and white telegram to virtual reality. We are finally giving human emotion a native file format, so it survives the journey across the internet.
But the most profound shift they are proposing isn't about what the message looks or feels like. It's about how it moves through time.
Yes, temporal messaging. Because the modern internet enforces a tyranny of the instant, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Read receipts, the typing bubbles, the expectation of an immediate reply. That speed generates immense biological anxiety. It keeps us in a state of hypervigilance.
Right. You send a vulnerable message,
yeah.
And immediately you are staring at your screen, waiting. And the silence just becomes deafening.
So 3.2.1 emotion introduces this concept of temporal messaging. Their philosophy is that emotion does not need to travel fast, it needs to travel well.
Travel well, I love that.
So you can compose a .emo message and intentionally program it to be delivered in the future. It arrives at a specific, chosen time.
And by removing the expectation of an instant reply, you remove the anxiety. The sender has the safety to be vulnerable because they know they won't have to deal with the immediate reaction.
Exactly. And the receiver gets to open it when they actually have the emotional bandwidth to process it. It creates the presence that real connection actually requires.
And they're also applying this infrastructure to how we meet people, right? They built an application called Alter Emo to directly counter the exhaustion of swipe culture.
Right. So instead of matching based on a curated photo, it matches people based on their emo DNA.
And emo DNA is basically an emotional signature based on how you actually feel and regulate your emotions over time, built from how you use that conversational mirror.
So you match based on emotional resonance and nervous system compatibility first.
Right. The photos and the visual identity are revealed later. You ensure the emotional fit is there before the visual judgment kicks in.
But it is crucial to understand that this infrastructural shift is not about creating flawless communication.
Oh, no. Flawless communication is artificial.
Right. Perfection actively kills connection.
Because if it's perfect, it's a performance. And performance suppresses vulnerability.
Exactly. The goal of this infrastructure is to create communication that is precise enough to carry what you actually feel, including all the hesitations, the messiness, and the imperfections.
Genuine reciprocity can only happen when your true, messy self is accurately received and held by another person.
Yeah, we've spent the last several decades pouring billions of dollars into building artificial intelligence. The next massive project for our generation has to be building emotional intelligence.
Not just as an individual therapy goal.
No, physically baking it into the spaces and networks between us.
So, if you take away anything from our deep dive today, especially if you've been feeling the heavy weight of this loneliness epidemic, let it be this. Your loneliness is a structural signal.
It's a biological siren.
Exactly. It's a siren going off, warning you that our current digital environment is fundamentally missing the tools required for vulnerability and reciprocity. You are not failing at connection.
No, you were handed tools built for advertising and endless scrolling.
And told to use them to build a community. It was an impossible task. But as we start to reimagine those spaces between us, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, building on that idea of temporal messaging.
Oh, it's a fascinating concept.
We have spent 15 years training our nervous systems to expect instant replies. We literally fear silence now. But what happens to our psychology when we begin receiving emotional messages from the future?
From the future?
Yeah. Imagine receiving a beautifully composed, emotionally rich .emo file from your own past self, sent 5 years ago when you were going through a hard time.
Wow.
Will our modern brains even know how to sit with that kind of emotional time travel? Or are we going to have to completely relearn how to listen to ourselves and to each other all over again? Something to think about the next time you find yourself staring at those three little gray typing bubbles.